From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Americans live today in a time generally free from the threats to life and psychological fears that accompanied the unchecked spread of infectious diseases in earlier periods of history. But how, in fact, in historical terms, does one measure the impact of communicable disease? Soundings put that question to one scholar who recently visited the National Humanities Center. He's William McNeil of the University of Chicago. Professor McNeil is the author of Plagues and Peoples, published in 1976.
Well, my interest in plagues and peoples was only in some kinds of disease, infectious disease, and particularly diseases that, without medical intervention, led to death.
What kinds of diseases are you talking
about?
Well,
that means epidemics, smallpox and measles and flu and whooping cough, many viral diseases, but also the plague and tuberculosis, things of this kind, which in the deeper past had very important effects, sometimes leading to as many as half the population or even larger proportions dying in a single year, in a single bad year. And this obviously had a tremendously important demographic effects. A society that loses half or a third or even a quarter of its population in a few weeks is just a different society from what it would be had those people survived.
Give me a couple of for instances.
Well, the most dramatic and the thing that brought me to this was reading about what happened in Mexico when Cortes was besieged in Mexico City, in Tepoztlan, and was driven out of the city. But at the same time, there was a smallpox epidemic raging amongst the Aztecs, who had never before been exposed to smallpox, and many, many thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of them died. And as a consequence, instead of their pursuing Cortes and cutting his heart open on the top of that pyramid of theirs, they stopped pursuing him, and within a few weeks, the allies, the subjects of the Aztecs, began joining Cortes to line up on his side against the Aztecs. And thinking about this, it occurred to me that the only conceivable explanation for what happened was that the Indians interpreted the fact that the Spaniards didn't get smallpox, whereas the Aztecs did, as a divine visitation, a divine sign that they were on the side of the Spaniards. And I can't think that Cortes would have survived had it not been for this. Now, that's a single example, but a very dramatic example of how epidemic disease. Well, there's a case in the Bible where Sennacherib comes down to besiege Jerusalem. And the angel of the Lord spread his wings, is the way the Bible says it. And when they woke up, they were all dead, which is a beautiful way to express the suddenness. We don't know what that disease was, but it destroyed, or at least so weakened, Sennacherib's army that he had to withdraw, and so did not capture Jerusalem. And in terms of the history of Judaism, this is an enormously important event, because it was the clearest demonstration of God's intervention that could be imagined at that time, and helped to confirm the prophetic vision of God's power over even the Assyrians, the greatest power of the age. Now are under God's power. God is protecting the people in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the history of Judaism, I could not think of a more important single moment for the success of the prophetic idea. And these are two examples, but they're not the only ones.
Why did historians not come to this stuff earlier? Why did they overlook it or ignore it?
It's not true that historians did not know that epidemic diseases happened and intervened sometimes dramatically and suddenly in history. But the difficulty from an historian's point of view is that you want, in writing history, to make sense of it. And when a disease hit in this way, it hits, as it were, outside of any pattern of causation or development that you can imagine. It just is there one day, and it's not there the day before, and it goes away 2 or 3 weeks or 5 or 6 weeks later. This is a very unsatisfactory way to write history. There is a book by Dr. Hans Zinsner called Rats, Lice, and History, which is full of stories of how a sudden outbreak of disease interrupted what otherwise looks like what should have happened. That is, Charles V was all ready to conquer Rome or something like that, and then his army gets infected and he fails. And there are many such stories. And Dr. Zinsner rather was laughing at historians for saying, look, here's something in history that you've just skipped over. But the whole thrust of an historian's mind is to make a story that is understandable. And these things, it's like hammer blows coming from outside, just broke the path of understandable development. So they weren't entirely overlooked. And certainly the Black Death, which came to Europe in the 14th century, has never been erased, but they tended to be minimized. You try to talk around it to make it less important. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that underlay this failure of historians to give disease its due was that in the 19th century, 18th and 19th centuries, when modern critical history began, epidemics of the kind that knock off half or a third or a quarter of the population no longer happened in Europe because of a disease homogenization, as I call it, deeper exposure to disease, which meant that adults were not subject to that kind of sudden die-off. So on the principle that what we know to be the case ought always to be the case in the past, when they got stories of these horrendous die-offs, 50% and so on, they said, well, they couldn't count, could they? And so sober accounts, or serious accounts, were simply discounted as saying they are exaggerating the number of deaths. Now, I don't mean that exaggeration doesn't occur, but the fact is that a population which does not have chronic exposure to one of these infectious diseases, so that a population grows up with no immunity to it, and then the disease arrives in that society, suddenly can have the quarter to a third to a half mortality. And because people in the 18th and 19th century didn't understand that, they rejected these stories as gross exaggerations. But if you understand just a little bit about epidemiology, you know that that is possible. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I must say they should have been aware of is that in their own time, the 18th and 19th centuries, peoples, not European, but the variously isolated populations, Amerindians and peoples in the South Sea Islands, were dying off in this horrendous fashion when they were exposed for the first time to civilized diseases.
Are you suggesting that history is really an outline of these connections between large and small organisms?
That's one way of looking at history. Let us say that's one dimension of history which historians have not well understood, largely because they paid very little attention to elementary epidemiology. And I was just lucky in writing my book that I had enough awareness of epidemiology, and stimulated by this puzzle over Cortes, began thinking about the larger course of human history and what time would it be that certain changes of communication would permit the diffusion of diseases in new fashions. And sure enough, the great rhythms of rise and fall of population and civilizations have this epidemiological dimension.
What do you mean by disease balance? What is that term?
In any given population at any given time, there will be a certain number of infections going round, and there will be a certain level of immunities which are either acquired or inherited, or a mixture of acquired and inherited immunities. And the tendency in any such system is to achieve a stable state. Now, the stability may consist of this fluctuating pattern over a number of years, something like an economic cycle. Or it may be a steady, much more nearly a steady state, but even so, there nearly always are seasonal peaks and valleys. It nearly always is an annual or sometimes biennial, triennial, quadrennial pattern of peaks and valleys, but a more or less stable state. Now, if a new infection comes into that society because of some contact from outside, or, see, it isn't always human. Sometimes it comes from an animal population. There's several examples of new diseases which came down from the trees in Africa. Monkeys had it, or some other kind of animal had it, and the virus or bacterium could transfer to a human host for a while. When that happens, then a new balance, and sometimes it can be extremely drastic, very heavy die-offs. The most dramatic example that I know about is what happened to rabbits in Australia, not human beings in this case, but by human intervention, a lethal infection was introduced amongst them, which when it first was being spread, had a 99.8 lethality, which means that out of 1,000 rabbits, 2 survived. I think that's right, 2 out of 1,000 at 99.8, yes. And in 3 years' time, the diminution of the virulence of the infection, because you see, an infection that kills its host has a terrible crisis finding another host. It tends to be a dead end for the virus if it kills its host too quickly. So there's a selection for viruses that are milder because they have a longer time in the animal and they have a better chance to travel to another animal. So there's a selection for a less virulent, that it doesn't kill the animal so quickly. And there's an equally obvious selection for animals that can survive by 3 years, this is a stable state again. Mm-hmm. It's in very marvelously rapid, 6 generations of rabbits. And the balance between this previously initially devastatingly lethal infection and the number of rabbits, the number of infections, the numbers who recover is stable.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a parallel to that kind of thing in human populations?
Oh, yes, the Black Death's the best example.
What was the die-off rate, as you say?
Well, in Europe, they've made pretty good calculations, and it's between 25% and 33%, it's between a quarter and a third, died in the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And if you just think about that, and sort of look around a room and say, now, supposing that one quarter to one third of all the people in this room were dead in 2 years' time, you can think of what that meant to the ongoing reality of European society. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there were comparably drastic die-offs in the Muslim world, and I suspect more drastic die-offs amongst the steppe peoples, though we don't really have data for that. So it's a real, it is the great catastrophe that was recent enough to be remembered. Mm-hmm. In modern times.
How reliable are the statistics that you looked at when taking all of that into account?
Not very, but the figure, 25% to 33% lethality in 2 years, is based upon a series of samples where they did have controlled populations. Often they were monasteries, as a matter of fact, where the numbers of monks were well recorded, the numbers who died, but not solely monasteries. Another place where you get relatively good statistics are cities. Italian cities used to keep records of the people buried. And you can see quite accurately. Mm-hmm. There's a marvelous series from Florence which tells you how many young women, they were enrolled in a list when they were infants, and if they lived long enough to get married, they got a dowry, so that anyone who died along the way was carefully recorded because it meant you didn't have to pay the dowry. So there are absolutely precise records for Florentine females, and this gives you a very accurate register of the lethality. It doesn't tell you what they died of. It doesn't say it's always plague, but it usually was plague, often was plague. I shouldn't say usually, often was plague. Mm-hmm. So these kinds of peaks and valleys in isolated communities are very accurate. You can be quite accurate, but you can't. You had to generalize. You had to say, well, we got this sample, that sample, that sample. Each of them runs between these limits of die-off percentage, so we generalize that for society as a whole. And sometimes you figure that parts of the society, parts of the country were not affected by the plague that year, and so you have to reduce your percentages. It's all inaccurate, but the level of certainty is pretty good. It's somewhere between a quarter and a third.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing Plagues and Peoples, did you reach any conclusions about the ratio of the number of diseases to species? How worried should we be to hear you talk about these things?
Well, one of the things that strongly came to my mind is this. The more effective our protection against disease becomes, and it's become very effective with modern medicine, the more we create a population that may become liable to some new kind of infection. The most dramatic case is the killing off of smallpox, and that has now been done. There is no more smallpox in the world. But in a sense, that opens a niche, to use the ecologist's language. And I think it is far from improbable that in the course of who knows how long, a century, 2 centuries, something like that, a new microorganism. It may not be human smallpox, but it would be a pox that would be enough like smallpox to be able to move into that gap. And here we are, none of us with any immunities any longer, because you don't get immunized against smallpox any longer. I talked to doctors about this. They have very elaborate plans of instant inoculation banks and so on of serum. But you know, if after a generation there's never been a case of smallpox, the money and the professional expertise keeping it at freezing temperatures or whatever else is necessary to keep it virulent is liable to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. So I think the victories of modern science, modern medicine in this respect, are enormous. And the difference of life from that which our grandparents knew, where a newborn child had a reasonable chance of dying before the age of 10, you know, is almost gone from us. Children do still die, but they don't usually die of infectious disease. But in my grandparents' day, that was not true. A mother, when the child was new, couldn't count on the child getting to its 5th or 10th birthday. But the role of infection as a intervening in a normal life, you have to think of a world until, let's say, 1750, in which the fact that you and I are quite healthy today doesn't really assure us that 48 hours from now or 72 hours from now, one of us won't be dead. Where you walked around the world always with that live possibility in mind, because so many of your fellows had had that experience. Fine today, sick tomorrow, feverish and unconscious the day after, and dead the third day. Mm-hmm. And this was part of human life. Now, after the middle of the 18th century, that ceases to be anything like as common except amongst small infants because of the much more intense circulation of diseases in all the civilized world. And the incidence of disease becomes quite different, and so the population patterns respond to this. And then by the end of the 19th century, it's really only after 1870, 1880, where the doctors become able to interfere with the path of the infectious organism, interrupt its transmission from person to person, and one after another disease falls before this. So that in my youth, actually, scarlet fever was still a genuine threat. I had a sister who nearly died of it. But today, there's hardly an infectious disease that anyone needs to be worried about, mm-hmm. because there are antibodies, there are steps the doctors can take. Even if they have not given you the necessary antibodies ahead of time to counteract the disease, mm-hmm. counteract the infection.
Mr. McNeil, how did you write this book? What did you have to look at? Where did you go? What did it involve? You're an interpreter here.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I suspect you felt that responsibility.
Well, of course, I read other people's books. I read accounts of diseases. And I had a general familiarity with the course of history from other work I had done. And really what happens is I thought, now, say, after 100 BC, there is a new kind of contact between China and Europe, the caravan route, and opening of systematic travel by sea, also the use of the monsoons. Now that very well might then have meant new opportunities for diseases to travel between China and Europe and the lands in between, Middle East and India. And it doesn't take very long to look. There are, in fact, catastrophic plagues which hit the Roman Empire in the 2nd century of the Christian era, which is 1.5 centuries or 2 centuries after this caravan road got going. And so after the European discoveries, when the ships start going through the high seas, everyone knows about that. Of course, then diseases start going in new paths, and you can find registers of that. That's what happened to the Aztecs. That's what happened to all the Amerindians, the depopulation of this country, these two continents from their native inhabitants is a function of the arrival of unfamiliar diseases from Europe and from Africa. And the population characteristics of North and South America could not be what they are without the role of disease. And when you start thinking about this, all kinds of things in the history of the world become meaningful that are understandable in a new way. Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, is the most disease-intensive environment in the whole world, which is one very good reason for thinking that's where men evolved. Men and their parasites evolved simultaneously. And that means, you see, that nobody can go into sub-Saharan Africa and thrive. Those that are there have learnt to live with all kinds of infections, which foreigners find lethal. And so Europeans and Muslims, Europeans and Asians alike, come to Africa and die like flies, which means Africa for the Africans. Very sound reason why the Africans do not suffer the same kind of fate that the Amerindians and the peoples of Oceania did when Europeans and Africans came with their diseases, breathed in their presence, and they died like flies. Mm-hmm.
Is the history of disease too important to leave to the medical statisticians and the epidemiologists?
Yes, of course. Historians ought to have something to say about it, and I did. It needs the cross-fertilization. You see, this book is a nice example of what can happen when you move across two disciplines which had for several generations been isolated from one another. And the epidemiologists hadn't thought about history particularly, and historians most certainly hadn't thought about epidemiology. So all you need is somebody who can sort of look across that back fence and say, aha, it's a kind of key to open locks that are otherwise mysterious. And this is something that can happen every so often, where a fertile cross-pollination of otherwise previously separated, it's very like a disease coming into a virgin population, as a matter of fact, having a marvelous time for a while when new hosts are all over the place and new pastures to graze upon. Now that I have made this, I think I know that other historians are much more conscious, some other historians are much more conscious of the irregular impact of disease upon the past, that you don't simply project backward the disease conditions of our age. You had to look to the age and understand the epidemiological conditions that prevailed at different ages and make the inappropriate recognition of this changing role of infectious disease amongst human populations.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion with William McNeil of the University of Chicago. Professor McNeil is the author of The Rise of the West, the National Book Award winner for history in 1963, Plagues and Peoples, published in 1976, and in 1982, The Pursuit of Power. With more on the subject of plagues and peoples, but now from a contemporary standpoint, here are comments from a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Seymour Cohen is a biochemist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. At the National Humanities Center, Professor Cohen is writing a book about the origins and history of chemistry in the United States. His topic for Soundings is what pharmacologists call orphan drugs.
Medical problems are being explored by many disciplines, and we know that the integration of the knowledge acquired by the separate disciplines is vital to practical medical application. Such integration is almost as difficult and time-consuming as the acquisition of the essential pieces of information themselves. The several kinds of investigation involved in designing a drug to treat an infection requires such integration, and the average time and investment leading to clinical use of a drug takes 10 years and about $50 to $100 million. It is not surprising, then, that such activity is limited in our medical centers and that our research personnel frequently cannot bring their hard-earned specialized discoveries to clinical utility. In these circumstances, one piece of information is like another, and almost the entire purpose of our biomedical enterprise is lost, with our best minds playing Atari games. Nor should it be surprising that the large costs of discovery, integration, and application compel the pharmaceutical houses to be cautious when investing in research. Will there be a market? If a pharmaceutical earns no more than $1 to $2 million a year, should companies be interested? In this context, the problem of so-called orphan drugs should be clear. A drug of interest to a small population cannot pay off and does not warrant investment unless the cost can be charged to the public at large through governmental support. Fortunately, a congressional bill supporting orphan drugs was approved this year without loud complaint from the public or private sectors. So far, so good. Developing biomedical research has created tremendous progress in separate medical and clinical disciplines. It is clear that our present store of science and technology, with respect to infectious disease, for example, could enable us to design a drug for any specific infectious disease, that is, bacterial, viral, fungal, or protozoan disease. Even diseases such as cancer may eventually fall within these capabilities. But these efforts of many disciplines would require integration of many research discoveries. The researchers themselves would clearly not be routine, but would be at the cutting edge of each discipline. Still, one obvious target for modern biomedical science and technology might be drug design to overcome viral and parasitic disease. Work on the chemotherapy of viral disease has been slow and difficult, but even worse, does not usually exploit our hard-won perspectives. For parasitic disease, modern research on drugs is essentially non-existent. Diseases of developing countries, such as malaria and trypanosomiasis, which afflict perhaps a third of the Earth's population, are scarcely subjects of pharmaceutical investment. Research to combat such disease receives only 3% of the funds available for the study of the diseases of the developed world. Developing nations cannot grow industrially and economically until the burdens of disease in these countries are sharply reduced. But while American and European interest in third world diseases is relatively minuscule, they are nevertheless crucial to American economic interests. A major reason for Western neglect is the difficulty of selling pharmaceutical products in developing countries and of recouping research and other investments. Sadly enough, even major diseases like malaria and the trypanosomiasis have become orphan diseases, reflecting the unwillingness of modern scientific institutions to apply themselves to disease problems well within the purview of modern science and technology. Out of sight, out of mind.
Seymour Cohen is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about the origins and history of chemistry in the United States. You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.